loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, British Prime Minister Theresa May announced this morning that she will expel 23 Russian diplomats in response to the poisoning of a Russian double agent in the UK. May declined to offer any evidence of Russian involvement in the poisoning during question time in Parliament, and Scotland Yard has said only that a nerve agent was used. Next, President Donald Trump was in California yesterday to personally inspect prototype sections of what would be a new border wall. He also took the opportunity to insult Governor Jerry Brown and the people of California for not supporting him in his immigration crackdown. Then, Defense Secretary James Mattis arrived in Afghanistan yesterday to meet with senior U.S. and Afghan officials and to discuss the possibility of peace talks with elements of the Taliban. Mattis told the press that the Taliban leadership has developed cracks in its unity in recent years and that now is the time to begin talking about the terms of peace. And then Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte said today that his country will immediately withdraw its ratification of the International Criminal Court's Establishing Treaty. This move comes amid a wave of repressive state violence targeting journalists, activists, and the poor. And finally, congressional legislation is being considered this week based on so-called right-to-try laws in several states. These laws allow terminally ill patients to immediately access any experimental treatments that aren't already approved by the FDA. However, over 99% of applications to the FDA are approved, usually within days of the application, and this dangerous idea could lead to human experimentation in addition to other harmful ills. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. First, we turn to the UK. British Prime Minister Theresa May announced this morning that she will expel 23 Russian diplomats in response to the poisoning of a Russian double agent in the UK. May declined to offer any evidence of Russian involvement in the poisoning during question time in Parliament, and Scotland Yard has said only that a nerve agent was used. We're joined from London by legendary anti-war activist and former British parliamentarian George Galloway. George, welcome back.
It's good to be with you again.
George, yesterday you were comparing this whole event to the Gulf of Tonkin, to the Zinoviev letter, in other words, to other incidents throughout history that have been proved later to be staged provocations or provocations in the sense that they were used as a pretext for some larger foreign policy or military operation. Do you still feel that way now that we've heard Theresa May's comments?
Yes, I absolutely do. The truth is that the British people have fallen out of love with prime ministerial assertions of other people's weapons of mass destruction, and still more with unnamed, unsourced intelligence information, which, of course, we can't see, we'll never see. And therefore, if that's all she's got, most people in Britain, I think this evening, will be saying, where's the beef? Especially when the retaliation kicks in. We don't know yet what Moscow will do in retaliation to the severe actions taken by the Prime Minister today, although some of them were laughable. She has decided that the British royal family will not, after all, be allowed to go to Russia for the World Cup this summer, which, as you Americans might put it in your constitution, does constitute cruel and even unusual punishment. But it's probably not going to be much discussed down on the streets of St. Petersburg. But other punishments are quite severe. 40% of the Russian diplomats in London are being given 7 days to leave the country. They decided to spare the wife of the ambassador, even though they gave consideration to expelling her. And they did some things that I approve of, actually. They decided to seize assets of Russian oligarchs in London, as they put it, to go after the criminally accrued wealth of the elites. Well, I'm in favor of that, as long as they don't stop at the Russians. I'm happy for Russian assets to be seized from the people who stole them. And we should do that with everybody's stolen assets, including British elites, of course. And equally, they said they want to dismantle Russia's espionage capability in London. Well, again, no one could argue with that. Again, as long as they don't stop at the Russians. I want to see all espionage networks in London disbanded, unraveled. And I could point to an embassy or two if they want to get started with other countries too. By and large, the country is quiet and calm and unconvinced.
All right. Let's sort of help the audience go through how this transpired, even though we did it yesterday and we're going to probably keep doing it.
It's very dynamic.
And the headlines are such that it would seem to the audience, yes, undoubtedly, this must be true that Russia and the Russian government and Russian intelligence agents poisoned a British double agent who was a Russian who had been in a Russian jail for 4 years. Russia released him many years ago. He's been living quietly in Salisbury, but suddenly he fell victim to a nerve agent attack. And the argument would be that the Russians, on the eve of Vladimir Putin's election, on the very eve of it, that they had their agents take a nerve agent and go ahead and disable and try to kill this individual and his daughter, who slumped down unconscious on a public park bench in the UK. I mean, in a way, it seems, as you asked the question, George, yesterday, who is the beneficiary? I mean, why would the Putin government on the eve of the election do such a public, and obviously it would be a public poisoning of this person who they, if they wanted to kill them, they could have killed them in Russia. His daughter lives in Russia. You could make it look like a robbery gone wrong at the whatever, but now it's a nerve agent that has a Russian signature on it. I mean, when you look at the big picture, and because you raised the issue of Gulf of Tonkin, or we could have talked about the sinking of the battleship Maine that started the Spanish-American War, or the Zinoviev letter right before the 1924 general elections in the UK, which indicated that the Soviet Union was doing all kinds of espionage in Britain at that time. Who is the beneficiary, and where does this lead? Where is this going?
Well, the beneficiary is undoubtedly those who wish to damage Russia and to worsen its place in the world, to damage Western relations with Russia, to accentuate the mentality of sanctions and ostracism and banning and so on. You don't have to be the late and great Professor Stephen Hawking to work that out. The one place that isn't remotely, credibly describable as a beneficiary is Russia itself. And you ran through very aptly, succinctly, the reasons for people's suspicion. This young woman lived in Moscow. She could have been strangled with her own scarf in an alleyway in Moscow at any time. This man was in a Russian prison. Could have fallen foul of an accident in the prison showers any time, or could have been killed any time in the quiet life you described as. I'm not sure how quiet it was, but in England over the last nearly 10 years that he has been living here, or they could have waited till after the elections, or they could have waited till after the World Cup. None of these things add up. They don't make any sense. And to kill two people with a nerve agent when you could have killed them with a bullet that would have been untraceable, a nerve agent invented in the former Soviet Union, long ago destroyed, as verified by the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Warfare, OPCW. Destroyed by Russia. I may tell you, America and Britain haven't destroyed theirs, but Russia did destroy theirs, as verified. So the idea that they would choose this time and that weapon to kill two people of no significance whatsoever is striking more and more people in Britain as literally incredible. And I don't mind betting that the wheels will start to come off this official cover story. I don't know, of course, who killed these people. Well, Russian intelligence are as capable of killing people as American intelligence or British intelligence or Israeli intelligence. And all four countries have killed many people over the years. I don't know who did it. I just know who's least likely to have done it. And I'm in a position to tell you that Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, was undoubtedly speaking for many millions today when he struck a querulous note, insisted on evidence, demanded the continuation of dialogue and channels of communication. But the Conservative government of Theresa May were not much in the mood for that.
Well, George, let's talk about that. Let's talk about Jeremy Corbyn. He's faced widespread criticism for not jumping on this anti-Russia bandwagon that we saw in Parliament this morning. Is this criticism sticking to him, or do people in the UK want to see the proof?
Well, I believe that people want to see the proof. Nobody can really say that they know what the British people think. There's not been any polling or anything like that. But my anecdotal evidence to you is that everyone, and I mean everyone that I have met today, and I have met many people today, has been of the same view as Jeremy Corbyn. Now, that's partly because the Blair legacy, the Iraq war legacy, has so poisoned people's trust in the state, in the intelligence apparatus, in prime ministers, in parliament, that if they told you today was Tuesday, you might have to check the date on the newspaper to check it, just to be sure. So that's partly the issue. The other issue is that the criticism is from the Conservatives. That's fair enough. But the Labour people criticizing Jeremy Corbyn are without exception the people who told us that Iraq had to be invaded because it was brimful of weapons of mass destruction. The followers of Tony Blair, who proliferate in Parliament, hundreds of them. And it's Jeremy Corbyn's real bad luck that he has become the leader of the Labour Party with overwhelming support from the party's membership in the country, but he continues to sit atop a pile of parliamentary, I don't want to say before the watershed, excrescence, the remnants of Blair. Remain in Parliament and undermine their own leader at every turn. It would be a bit like Bernie Sanders being the president of the United States and the Democratic Party constantly undermining him at every turn. That's a bit like how Jeremy Corbyn must feel.
Again, an ongoing story that we will continue to cover. We were joined from London by legendary anti-war activist and former British parliamentarian George Galloway. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Donald Trump was in California yesterday to personally inspect prototype sections of what would be his new border wall. He also took the opportunity to insult Governor Jerry Brown and the people of California for not supporting him in his immigration crackdown. We're joined from Los Angeles by Carolyn Gomez. She's an organizer with the National Union of Healthcare Workers. Carolyn, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So Donald Trump went to California, where he was largely unwelcome, and he looked at the prototypes for his big, beautiful border wall that the Mexicans are going to pay for.
He's shopping.
He made a ridiculous comment I saw on the morning news programs today that some of the prototypes are easier to climb over than others, and he's going with the ones that are hard to climb over. So was this a serious visit? Was this a PR thing? What really was he doing in California yesterday?
Yeah, you know, it sounds more like a PR stunt and kind of a bullying tactic. For quite some time, he didn't come to California because he was met with great resistance up in Burlington and also in Los Angeles. And so we know that this is just a part of his strategy to continue his bullying and really to instill fear in people. But, you know, and his comment about the wall, and he even said that, you know, he said these people are good climbers, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he did say that.
And the way that the map looks, there's already a fence. That fence stretches about 2,000 miles across the Southwest. And, you know, he's trying to build like another wall in between that. But we have Operation Streamline and Operation Gatekeeper that, you know, Operation Gatekeeper essentially militarized the U.S. border. And so not only is there that fence, but there's now all these militarized Border Patrol agents and even militia groups who are able to patrol the border with them. And, you know, with Operation Streamline, that was just another mess that's currently happening. It essentially takes away habeas corpus from immigrants in detention centers and keeps them there for a prolonged time. So for Trump to come and say that, you know, that there needs to be more security on the border is ridiculous, especially that, you know, most people that are in prison, I think it was about, like in federal prison, immigrants make up about 5%. And there's all these countless studies that show that, you know, most of the crimes are not committed by undocumented people.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, you know, this is another important thing, too, is that this rhetoric has emboldened people on the far right, these militia groups. We know that they're going out into the desert and they're, for example, pouring out water that others have left in jugs in the desert in case there's somebody who's making the crossing, just so they don't die of thirst in the middle of the desert somewhere.
And ICE agents are doing the same.
ICE agents doing exactly the same and filming it.
Yeah, and filming it, like pouring out water so really thirsty, dehydrated people in the middle of the desert will die.
Yeah. I want to point something out, too, that most of these prototypes that we're talking about, that Carolyn has referred to, have bars at the bottom, so it's almost like prison bars, and then the top part of the wall is an actual wall. So it's 30 feet tall. The first 10 feet are bars, steel bars, so that the Border Patrol agents can see through, ostensibly to see if somebody's hiding in the shadows or hiding in the bushes and is going to make a run for it. It's like this weird kind of paranoia now.
Paranoia, but also, you know, people are making a lot of money.
Oh,
not
millions.
Not the people who need money in America, but Carolyn, I was just looking at some of the stats. The Trump administration's 2019 budget request for the Department of Homeland Security asked Congress for $1.6 billion, and just because we don't know billions and trillions, it's hard for normal people to understand these numbers. $1.6 billion would be 1,600 millions to build 65 miles of the wall, just 65 miles. And what you're talking about is that there's already wall or some kind of barrier for 2,000 miles. We're talking about all the way from the Rio Grande in southern tip of Texas all the way to the Pacific Ocean. I mean, what a waste of money.
Definitely. A memo that was released last February 2017 estimated the wall. It was released from the Department of Homeland Security. It was estimating the wall at a cost of over $21 billion.
I mean, with $21 billion, John, you could start another war in the Middle East.
Indeed. That's the seed money for our third front. I mentioned in the intro that Trump insulted Governor Jerry Brown and the people of California. It really was an insult. He said, and I'm going to quote here, we have a lousy wall over here right now, but at least it stops 90-95%. When we put up the real wall, we're going to stop 99%, maybe more than 99%. And it says here, he went on to criticize Jerry Brown, saying that Brown was presiding over sky-high tax rates and the state's sanctuary policies put the entire nation at risk. Now, Jerry Brown, to his credit, tweeted back at Donald Trump and said, look, we've got the sixth largest economy in the world. We have the highest growth, excuse me, of any state in America. You need to get your facts straight. We ought to be used to Donald Trump by now criticizing people and trying to pick a fight. But I think there's more to it with California. I think he really hates California. And I want to point out, too, that Donald Trump is the first president in the last century to not visit California in his first year as president. I think there's something behind that.
Carolyn, you're in California. You're in Southern California. Obviously, the vote did not go well for Donald Trump in California. But aside for the electoral issue, what is the mood in the area that you are? What's the mood inside both the immigrant community, among working people? Donald Trump comes, the media all comes with him. They give him all this free press for his racist demagogy and, you know, sort of whipping up more and more animus and hatred towards immigrant peoples and against Mexicans. What's the mood?
You know, people are really organizing. I feel like there's a lot of people that are really rethinking where we're at, how we got here. And, you know, right after the Trump election, for example, there was kind of, and I think this, I don't know how it was across the United States, but it was just this feeling of kind of like despair. But over time, I think sort of like a mourning. But I think over time, people have realized that, you know, we need to organize. We need to let our voice be known that this person is not representative of the workers here. And for example, yesterday there was countless demonstrations in Tijuana, in San Diego, Los Angeles, even Beverly Hills, where hundreds of people came out to those different locations to voice their you know, let their opinions be known. It was it was like a milieu of different people. It was multinational, a lot of people of different ages, a lot of youth out there, mostly. Centered around immigrants' rights, bigotry, you know, fighting for the defense of women. And it was very powerful. I was able to attend the protests in Los Angeles and Beverly Hills. And, you know, so it was great to see people from both locations there, right? And, you know, in Los Angeles, we protested Trump at the hotel that he was at, right in the middle of downtown Los Angeles. And there was a lot of great kind of agitational speeches that were being talked about, pointing out that the militarization of the police and the LAPD and the amount of murders that they participate in every year, the amount of money that's going into this border wall, where when we could actually, you know, we could actually put that money for the interests of the people, the interests of the workers who make it happen, who make California the sixth largest economy in the world, right? So I think that it's important for people to continue, you know, putting out the message out there that we need to organize against this presidency, but also the system that's allowed him to get into place with the Electoral College and all that situation. So I think it's necessary and people are moving. So it's good to see.
Carolyn, in Texas, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the Texas law allowing the Governor Greg Abbott signed, whereby the state can ask anyone they detain, law enforcement can ask anyone they detain about their immigration status, and jurisdictions in Texas that violate the law are subject to fines of up to $25,000 each day. And local officials who say no to that terrible unconstitutional law can be removed. I mean, Carolyn, this is legalizing, even though it can't be legalized because it's not legal, it's not constitutional, the racial and ethnic and national profiling of entire huge parts of the population in Texas and thus around the country.
Right. I mean, I think that's absolutely absurd. And I think that, you know, the more that people kind of understand the implications of this, the better it would be for everyone. It's really ridiculous that in the state of Texas, they would try to do something like that. And you really see this like turmoil between, you see how California is handling it, where they're trying to protect the constitutional rights that immigrants do have, because they do have rights, some rights, not all. But, you know, it's really going to be a battleground. It's going to be interesting to see how every state reacts to this. And I think that, you know, I hope to see more organizing or like what the kind of organizing comes out of Texas from this. I know they have a strong resistance there as well. You know, people across the United States just aren't going to stand for this. So it's going to be really great to see this happen and develop.
I think you're right. I think you're totally right. And of course, in the case of Texas, Texas was Mexico. San Antonio was, in fact, the northern capital of Mexico until the U.S. took control of it by means of invasion and occupation and seizure. And now you have Mexican Americans living in Texas subject to being asked by law enforcement, should they get stopped for a traffic stop? Are you, tell us your immigration status. It's disgusting. It's racist. It's terrible. But Carolyn's right, John. People are going to fight back. They have to fight back.
They have to. This is just the start. We're going to have to end it there, though. We were joined from Los Angeles by Carolyn Gomez. She's an organizer with the National Union of Healthcare Workers. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Defense Secretary James Mattis arrived in Afghanistan yesterday to meet with senior U.S. and Afghan officials and to discuss the possibility of peace talks with elements of the Taliban. Mattis told the press that the Taliban leadership has developed cracks in its unity in recent years and that now is the time to begin talking about the terms of peace. We're joined from Iowa by Brian Terrell, a longtime peace activist and a co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Brian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Brian, this really isn't what it is cracked up to be in the press, is it? You've got the Secretary of Defense going to Afghanistan to talk about a war that we've been fighting for almost 17 years now. We're not winning. We don't even really know what the definition of winning is in this context. And now, after all these years, Mad Dog Mattis, as he's known, wants to talk to the Taliban.
Before Brian comments, I want to read his exact words.
Excellent.
Okay, here it goes. We look forward toward a victory in Afghanistan, not a military victory. Okay.
Exactly.
That means we're going to win by not winning.
Exactly.
Just a few months ago, President Trump said that we are not about nation building, we're about killing bad guys, and the gloves are off, and it's all this is a departure. And it's also very, at this time when the shakeup in the State Department and everything is at the closest thing that there is to a diplomat in this administration, is a general named Mad Dog Mattis, who is going to be involved in peace talks with the Taliban. It's also very noteworthy that General Nicholson, who's the military commander in Afghanistan, just yesterday too announced that the United States is seeing it needs to step up its security in Kabul, which until the last months has been a relatively place relatively under the control of the Afghan government, but that recognition that even with these talks going on, that they're expecting more involvement of the Taliban in the capital city of Kabul. So it's this isn't good for anybody in Afghanistan. It's always been warlords that the United States has been propping up, and it won't matter whether these are going to be called the Northern Alliance or the Afghan government or the Taliban.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's the reality there. You'd have to ask yourself, if you're a soldier or a Marine, you're sent to a frontline area, you're now going to kill people or be killed or both. Your parents are aware that you're on the front lines. You're doing it because you're in the military, but always, you think, okay, I'm risking my life. I'm prepared to make the supreme sacrifice, blah, blah, blah. And then you also have to ask yourself, and this must be for a good cause. So then we have the leader of the Pentagon saying, we look toward a victory in Afghanistan, not a military victory. The victory will be a political reconciliation with the Taliban. So now you're that soldier or that Marine on a frontline thing saying, I might die today. I might kill people today. But it's so that there can be a reconciliation with the Taliban. Wow, that just doesn't seem like a huge morale boost as you're going into battle. And certainly, if the U.S. wanted to have a, quote, reconciliation, that could have happened a long time ago. The U.S. used to have relations with the Taliban.
You know, this brings to mind the famous John Kerry question before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in, I think it was 1971, who wants to be the last man to die for a mistake? Well, this has to be the question that every one of our soldiers, whatever the term is now, soldiers, sailors, Marines, warfighters, airmen, whatever, has to ask himself. Now, you're right about the Taliban. The Taliban have been talking about reconciliation talks for at least a decade, and they have several times made their way to Doha, the capital of Qatar, at the invitation of the Qatari government in order to carry out those talks. But it's been the American side and the American-supported Afghan government side that has decided so many times that they're not interested in peace talks.
Go ahead, Brian. And I think, and tell us if I might be getting this wrong, but I believe the last Taliban leader was assassinated with a drone by a drone attack during the Obama administration as he was coming back from negotiations, as he was coming back from talks. Anyway, go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, well, that's just it. As he's coming back from talks in Iran, that's the we want if there's any kind of peace that the United States wants, it's a peace on U.S. terms, and it's a peace that's going to leave the markets and the availability of the mineral and mineral wealth of Afghanistan open to U.S. companies, a cessation of hostilities that will leave an advantage to Iran, say, or to China or to Russia is not a desired peace. And I think the question is, and I think it was probably just as much appropriate in the times of John Kerry and 1971 or so, is not just about who's going to die for a mistake, but is this a mistake or is it a crime? Is this a matter of good intentions gone awry, of nation building of efforts that have failed, or is this a systematic and very successful organized attack on a civil society in Afghanistan? After you see these apparent mistakes reeling out over the years and the decades, you really have to wonder if these are mistakes at all.
Yeah. And Mattis, by the way, was the commanding officer in southern Afghanistan in 2001.
That's right.
When this all started. It's the invasion of Afghanistan started October 7th, 2001. Mattis was there.
That's how he made a name for himself.
Yeah. And so here we are 16 years later, going on 17. And the U.S. is still there. So many thousands of Afghans have died, Brian. I mean, so many. And, you know, I saw way back when, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, there was a poll done by an outside international polling survey company among Afghans in the southern part of Afghanistan where the U.S. was doing its heaviest fighting. And they asked people what they knew about the attacks on the World Trade Center in September 11, 2001. 93% of the people surveyed had never heard of the World Trade Center. I mean, and yet they're the people whose villages are being bombed.
Just stunning.
Yeah, the median age in Afghanistan now is just over 18 years old. And so the majority of people there were not born yet or babies in arms when that happened. And they're still being punished for it.
One of the things that we're noticing, John, also is that a big part, this is a military failure. It's also a failure if the U.S. wanted to create a pacified situation in Afghanistan with a puppet government or a proxy government that would do the bidding of the U.S., that would take contracts from U.S. contractors. A big part of the investment now in Afghanistan, I think, and Brian, you'll know more, is Chinese. But what the U.S. has going for it is all these military operations, military contractors, they're making a killing in Afghanistan. Go ahead, Brian.
Oh yeah, they will continue to, you know, however this turns out, you know, except unless peace breaks out, which would be something that I believe that these interests are actively trying to keep from happening and will not and will try to prevent. So this is not I don't think this is any kind of step toward anything that we'd really recognize as peace.
Let me ask you real quick. We have less than 2 minutes. Mattis is saying it's not negotiations with the entire Taliban. He says the U.S. is going to peel off different parts of the Taliban who are, quote, sick of fighting. You know, the American soldiers, they're fighting and they basically want to come home, right? I mean, that's their goal. But the Taliban and the Afghans are home. I mean, they're not going anywhere. They live there. They've lived there for a long time. Not just the Taliban, but, you know, the people with their families and then their villages. Is there a part of the Taliban that's going to peel off?
Oh, there'll always be people who can be bought. And but the fact is that this is, whether you call it the Taliban or the ISIS or whatever, it's an insurgency against an occupation. And it will continue in one way or another as long as the occupation continues. You know, this is the core of it. For a long time, it's been said, many people who know more than I do, that the Taliban continues to exist because of the occupation.
Yeah, Matthew Ho, the State Department official who had served in Afghanistan, said he resigned because he said the American military presence was the catalyst for the armed insurgency.
Yes.
Not just Taliban, there's lots of them.
I can't tell you how many Al-Qaeda fighters I captured and interrogated over the years who told me that they had no specific problem with the United States, but when we started bombing their villages and killing their relatives, they had no alternative but to take up arms against us.
A very important point. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined from Iowa by Brian Terrell, a longtime peace activist and a co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte said today that his country will immediately withdraw its ratification and participation in the International Criminal Court's established treaty. That's the ICC. The move comes amid a wave of repressive violence targeting journalists, activists, and the poor. We're joined from San Jose, California, by Adrian Bonifacio, National Chairperson of Anak Bayan USA. Adrian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
What do you and what does your organization, Anak Bayan USA, feel about this announcement by the president of the Philippines to withdraw from the ICC? And why is he doing it?
Well, Duterte's withdrawal from the ICC, it's a clear indication that he's panicking more and more, and he's running away from a potential prosecution because he himself knows it. He's guilty. He's guilty for mass murder, for what he would probably be trialed as crimes against humanity. There was a youth congresswoman in the Philippines, part of Kabataan Party List, who put it perfectly, who said that only the guilty become too eager to run away from prosecution. And so we see that Duterte's withdrawal from the Rome Statute, which established the ICC, is really an indication that the administration, the regime itself, knows that it's guilty.
I mean, there is a wave of terror going on against people associated with drug use, and we're talking about not just big drug dealers or the banks who launder drug money. We're talking about poor people, people who are either using drugs or addicted to drugs or even small dealers of illegal substances. I mean, it's a war, but it's more than that. That's what's captured the attention of the media. It's also a war, as you put it in Anak Bayan USA, it's a war against the press. It's a war against independent journalists. It's a war against political activists. Describe what's going on in the Philippines.
Right. So, like you mentioned, the drug war is only part of the Duterte regime's fascist attacks on the people. The drug war itself is a war against the poor. You made the distinction between there are the big drug lords, the big drug pushers, and then urban poor, people who are either pushed to use drugs because there's no other opportunity or there's no other way to get economic livelihood in the Philippines, or they're simply innocent people who are targeted and meeting the quotas of the Philippine police. And so on the one hand, you have as some estimates go up to 20,000, almost 20,000 deaths from the drug war. A lot of it, again, people who are just impoverished. And these are statistics from Philippine government agencies themselves that say that there are, of course, an underestimate of 4,000 deaths, but at the same time, 16,000 cases that are still under investigation. And we know that a lot of the times those cases under investigation won't be solved because the police won't admit their fault to it. And so you have thousands of deaths on the one hand of poor people, innocent people. And then on the other hand, you have big drug pushers like Kerwin Espinosa, Peter Lim, who were actually, their charges were just dropped against them due to a lack of evidence. So on the one hand, you have people who are killed, summarily executed without any evidence. And then you have big drug pushers who admit that they are raking in 50 million pesos annually, who are dropped because they don't have enough evidence against them. And so you have a fascist war on the poor through the drug war. And then there's other attacks on the people. Martial law, a military rule, is still in effect on the island of Mindanao, which is one of the largest islands in the Philippines, which caused the forced evacuation of almost 500,000 people. It totally leveled the city of Marawi. There are people who say it looks like places in the Middle East, in Syria, just because of the bombing. And then you have a war on community organizers, on human rights defenders, on activists. You have what Duterte calls Oplan Kapayapaan, or Operational Planned Peace, which is couldn't be further from the truth. It's targeting human rights defenders. It's targeting indigenous rights activists, environmental justice activists. Most recently, this week alone, he released a list of so-called quote-unquote terrorists that includes people who are simply people fighting for their right to humanity and fighting for their right to live in this country. And so we can really see there's almost a triple war of oppression against the Filipino people through the drug war, through martial law in Mindanao, and through this war on activists and community organizers.
That's the voice of Adrian Bonifacio. He's the chairperson of Anak Bayan USA. We're talking to him from San Jose, California. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM, or you can subscribe as an iTunes podcast. Adrian, let's talk about the genesis, or maybe that's not the right word, the trajectory of the Duterte government. When Duterte first came in, he announced that there would be peace talks with the National Democratic Front aimed at potentially ending the armed struggle that began in the late 1960s. He made overtures to at and in China, announcing that he would be independent from the United States. It seemed to be a remarkable sort of shift in Philippine political orientation. And yet over the last year, the peace talks have been shelved. The sort of the re-cementing, or I don't know, maybe it was always cement, the relationship with the United States was reaffirmed. And at the same time, Duterte has transformed into what you now characterize as a fascist regime. What accounts for this profound dynamic sort of up and down and then ultimately shift to the far right on the part of Duterte?
Right. And especially over the past year, we've seen Duterte really bowing down to the former and current neocolonial master, U.S. He's really bowed down to U.S. imperialist dictates. When Trump visited last year during the ASEAN summit, Duterte even sang Trump a love song. They were talking about increasing military aid to the Philippines, about Trump's support for the drug war. And so we know that in all of this, when we say the Duterte regime is responsible for the fascist attacks, we are actually saying that it's a U.S. Duterte regime. It's a regime in the Philippines that's backed by U.S. money. It's backed by U.S. political support because of the strategic position of the Philippines in U.S. foreign policy. Trump even went so far as to say that the Philippines is a prime piece of real estate for its strategic posturing in the Asia Pacific. And so we see Duterte bowing down to that influence, those dictates that are being placed upon the government. And so instead of really listening to the people and being on the side of the people, Duterte has chosen the side of the U.S. And so that's why for Anak Bayan USA in particular, we're of course attacking and we're targeting the Philippine government as the perpetrator of these actions, but we're also definitely targeting the U.S. government as well for its support. And so a lot of the work that we've done here in the U.S. is to bring light to that connection between the two. And so most recently, you talked about the trajectory. We really see this as potential dictatorship, right? We saw this under Ferdinand Marcos in the 60s and 70s and 80s, which was also backed by the U.S. And so we want to prevent at all costs the imposition of another dictatorship in the Philippines, which is why Anak Bayan USA is part of a broad alliance called Malaya, the Malaya Movement, which means free or freedom in Tagalog. That is doing petition gathering. We're actually hosting a national caravan of human rights defenders and speakers that'll be going from coast to coast, from DC to the Midwest to the West Coast, on in April and May. And we're really calling on all folks here in the U.S. and looking for solidarity support to end the impending dictatorship in the Philippines so that we can make sure that we never again have another Marcos.
Yeah. Adrian Bonifacio is our guest. Adrian, just if people wanted to get involved with those actions, what is the website, and what is the website for Anak Bayan USA?
Sure. So the website for the Malaya movement, which is the one that's helping to host the Stop the Killings caravan, which is going from coast to coast end of April to May, the website is malayamovement.com, MALAYA movement.com. And then to hear more about Anak Bayan USA, our website is anakbayanusa.org. That's A-N-A-K-B-A-Y-A-N. USA.org.
Okay. And Adrian, in terms of the struggle in Mindanao, in the southernmost enlarged island in the Philippines, where so much terror has been going on from the government, as you described it, it looked like one of the bombed out cities in the Middle East. What's the level of resistance in Mindanao? We have 1 minute left.
The resistance is great. And that's part of the reason why Duterte is cracking down so hard on community organizers, activists, and even the revolutionary movement that is operating in Mindanao, and that there's a huge mass movement that's protesting the crimes against peasant activists, against human rights defenders, farmers. And then in the countryside, they're also waging a revolutionary war of resistance against the military, where over 60% of the military is actually deployed in Mindanao, because the people's fervor and the people's desire for justice to fight back against a fascist regime is so great that the revolutionary movement down there has also grown in strides.
Okay, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from San Jose, California, by Adrian Bonifacio, National Chairperson of Anak Bayan USA. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Congressional legislation is being considered this week based on so-called right to try laws in several states. These laws allow terminally ill patients to immediately access any experimental treatments that are not already approved by the FDA. However, over 99% of applications to the FDA are approved, usually within days of those applications, and this dangerous idea will lead to human experimentation, in addition to other harmful ills. We're joined from New York by Mark Harrington. He's the executive director of the Treatment Action Group. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Mark, I want you to walk us through the ethical and legal issues surrounding this. You know, on the one hand, if somebody is dying of a terminal illness, they're desperate. They're desperate for any kind of a treatment, maybe a cure. On the other hand, it really does lead to and endorse human experimentation. So what exactly are we looking at here?
Well, this bill doesn't really solve a problem in a coherent way. It's based on the idea that the Food and Drug Administration, which oversees, or the FDA, which oversees drug development in the United States, is somehow a barrier to access for experimental therapies to people who are sick and don't have any other options and may die. And the reality is that the FDA, especially since the efforts of the AIDS activists in the 80s and 90s, which I was involved in, has created a number of pathways for expanded access to experimental medications. So about 99% of them, the applications go through. People who have who need these experimental therapies, the FDA is not the chief barrier. The chief barriers are the manufacturers, limited drug supply, limited evidence, and the fear and the very justified fears of the manufacturers that giving drugs that have only been in phase one to very sick patients might actually make them worse, not better, because we don't know anything about whether those drugs work by the time they get out of phase one, which is when this bill would make them eligible.
And if the FDA is approving 99% of these applications, where's the oversight? Who's in charge of making sure that this is moral and ethical and legal?
The people who oversee the approval of the drug oversee the expanded access into that drug. So if you're assigned to, let's say, you're in charge of drugs for Ebola virus. You're going to also be in charge of the same expanded access, and you'll be in charge of the compassionate use, and you'll be in charge of the post-marketing surveillance. And so you're going to know a lot about that drug and that disease. In the current bill, the right to try legislation removes the FDA entirely from the expanded access process, and it doesn't really say who would administer it. It doesn't necessarily mean that there will be any coordination between this right to try process and what the FDA review is going to be. And so it has a danger of actually taking away the expertise that we now have that is part of the regulation of these drugs and their development. And the bill, I needed to add that the bill doesn't, nobody's going to gain access because of the bill if the access reasons are denied because there's not enough drug or the companies are worried about the safety, et cetera. And there's no way that we can, there's no way the U.S. Government can compel a company to release a drug if it's not yet proved to be safe and effective. So there's nothing in this bill that necessarily would actually get these drugs to the so-called desperate patients who need them. And it's unclear how the reporting on the use of these drugs would actually filter back into the FDA review process, if in fact it ever filtered back at all. So this bill is solving a problem that doesn't exist, and it doesn't solve the problem that does exist, which is that not all sponsors want to use the existing pathways for expedited review, and I can't really imagine that they would want to use this pathway because it will only distract them from their, they would still want to, if they still want to get a drug to market, they're still going to have to go through the traditional pathway.
Mark, I want the audience to understand the history that you alluded to in the beginning. And you mentioned you were part of the movement to force the FDA to expedite the use of drugs and therapeutic treatment options that weren't fully approved yet during the fight against AIDS in the 1980s. A lot has changed. That's what you were alluding to. I want you to help the audience understand how that change took place and precisely what it means that there's these new expedited avenues, because that was, of course, a point of extreme frustration and activism and struggle at that time. Just talk about what happened.
Yeah, sure. Back in the 80s, AIDS was a new disease and there were no treatments for it. And so ACT UP was formed in 1987, partly around the high price of AZT, which was the first drug that was ever released for AIDS. And one of the big issues that quickly came to the fore was that there was a lot of drugs in experimental trials. And yet, even as those drugs move closer towards showing efficacy and safety, no one could get access to them except for through research. And so AIDS activists first demonstrated and later had meetings with the FDA and the researchers that were funded by the National Institutes of Health, and then directly with the industry, the companies that were making the drugs. And by 1999, we had persuaded them all to join a system called Parallel Track or Expanded Access, which allowed people with AIDS that didn't have other treatment options and couldn't get into the trials of newer AIDS drugs to get access to some of them through this so-called parallel track or expanded access. And that was also regulated by the FDA. The data went to them and was used in the application, which would be submitted for approval of the drug after they proved to be safe and effective. And then they even provided accelerated approval starting in 1992, which would allow drugs to be approved on the basis of a change in biological markers, which were believed to predict that the drug would actually work. And so after a four-year campaign in 92, by 92, the FDA had created basically everything you see today in terms of what's available for expanded access, which is that you can get, before approval, you can get a drug in a clinical trial, or you can get it through expanded access, or you could also, in some cases, get it on the underground because there was a pretty big AIDS drug underground in those days, although in the case of the underground, you didn't know if they were safe or effective, and the FDA sometimes clamped down on them. So the FDA showed that it has the power to really be very compassionate and allow the use of these treatments, and they've been expanding that through cancer and other diseases, so that really there's a lot of, like you said before, about 99% of expanded access applications are now reviewed and approved by the FDA within days. which, I mean, shows that the FDA is not the main obstacle for pre-approval access for people. And so the right to try is really giving out false hopes that additional people will be getting this access, which people who apply already get it. And in reality, the issues around companies not wanting to share the drug or not being sure if they're safe enough are very real and cannot be made to disappear through legislation.
Tell us, who exactly is pushing this on Capitol Hill? It has to be coming from somewhere.
There's two different forces at work. One of them is just sort of a general group that wants to generally deregulate and weaken the FDA, weaken regulation, weaken federal oversight of public health. And that, and FDA has been in their sights ever since ACT UP was targeting the FDA back in the late 80s. Organs like the Wall Street Journal were promoting deregulation, and they would hijack some of the AIDS activist rhetoric to make it sound like we were actually fighting for the same thing, but we weren't. We wanted safe and effective drugs for AIDS faster. They wanted to weaken the FDA. And so there's one group of people who want to weaken the FDA, which has been protecting Americans by insisting on drug safety and efficacy for more than 100 years, since 1906. And then there's another group of people, some of which are suffering from very serious diseases, which the disease may not have a very large constituency, and so there may be a very small amount of investment into it. And some of these diseases are very serious. Some are genetic, some are others are autoimmune or neurological, but there's no approved treatments or very few, and that the treatments aren't very good. And so the pressure for access to experimental medications is very strong. Many of the sponsors are small biotech companies that don't have extra money to invest in expanded access. And there are heartbreaking stories where people can't get access to something that is being studied, and when it really isn't known whether that substance is going to be safe or not. And so, again, the FDA's expanded access program will consider treatments like that for expanded access, but maybe the small biotech company doesn't really have enough on hand. This bill will not solve that problem.
I just don't know where to turn on this issue. It's, you want to do whatever you can to help people who are suffering and who are dying, but I think that that Mark is right. This bill doesn't answer these questions. This bill doesn't really help those people.
Yeah, and the other thing, Mark, and we just have about a minute left. And I mean, in terms of drug development in general, of course, if a pharmaceutical doesn't feel like there's a golden pot at the end of the rainbow, maybe there is less money, less research. And that, of course, doesn't mean anything to people who are actually suffering, even if they're a small part of a demographically speaking or statistically, they are the people and those are their families. 30 seconds left.
There's something that could be done that would be very easy to help expand the FDA's ability to do a good job of overseeing drug development and protecting patient health and allowing access, which would be to fill the more than 400 open positions which are unfilled at the FDA because it's been underfunded by Congress for the last two decades. And so Congress likes to complain that the FDA doesn't approve drugs fast enough, which, if you look at the data, isn't actually true anymore. But they don't have enough staff to do their job because Congress underfunds them. And so rather than starting a new process that nobody knows how it would work and that wouldn't work, the easiest solution for Congress to solve the problems at the FDA would be to give it to fully fund it.
We're going to have to leave it there. Mark Harrington is our guest. Mark, tell us how people can learn more about the Treatment Action Group.
We work on HIV, Hep C, and tuberculosis, and we're online at www.treatmentactiongroup.org.
Thank you. Very important discussion, John. We were joined by Mark Harrington. We talked to him from New York. He is the executive director of the Treatment Action Group.
You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can now follow us on Twitter, at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m., on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.